Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 746 of the podcast. And it is Saturday, the 13th of April, 2024, as I record this. In today's show, I have a discussion with Tristra New Year Jaeger about the impact of generative AI on creativity and business in the music industry. And we also talk about the creator economy and having more fun with our creativity. So I loved talking to Tristra. We get on really well. We had a real giggle. So even if you're not into music, you will find this interesting in terms of creative business, and it will hopefully leave you with a smile. So that's coming up in the interview section. In publishing industry news, Drafter Digital announced a retail distribution agreement with Fable. Fable is an online bookstore and social reading app that powers tens of thousands of online book clubs. The venture-backed company already lists 25,000 book clubs, 650,000 active readers, and 200 influencer partners from BookTok, BookTube, and Bookstagram. The store lists over a million titles from every one of the big five and key independent publishers, but Drafter Digital is the first to supply titles from indie authors. If you publish with Drafter Digital, you can just opt in, which I have already done for all my books. Any questions, just ask the friendly team at support@draft2digital.com, and there's more information on the blog, links in the show notes. Also, lovely to see a new e-reading device from Kobo. So Rakuten Kobo introduces book lovers to its first ever colour e-ink e-readers with the new Kobo Libra Colour and Kobo Clara Colour, turning the page on the exclusively black and white digital reading experience Kobo fans know and love. A subtle palette that retains the benefits of e-ink technology now in colour. So if you don't use an e-reading device, it means that it's not hard on your eyes, which is great. And I actually love this because a few years ago, people were like, oh, people will just read on their phones, or they'll just they won't need a dedicated device. But I think that I read on a dedicated device, not this one, but the Kobo devices are really lovely. And I really think an e-reading device is something that book people love. And I read on mine in bed. So when you don't want any other distractions, when you don't want to have email on the same device, like on reading on my phone, I find quite difficult because there's always some other possibility with the phone. But yes, with the capacity to store thousands of books, a long battery life, 24/7 access to the Kobo bookstore, and OverDrive integration to easily borrow library books, book lovers can stock their shelves wherever they go. Okay, so that is there's a press release there, links in the show notes. More specifically for indie authors, selfpublishingadvice.org, which is from the Alliance of Independent Authors, has a new ultimate guide to subscription models. And this is actually really good because we talk about subscription a lot, but there are lots of different versions of subscription. So they have third-party reader subscriptions like Kindle Unlimited and Kobo Plus, paid newsletter subscriptions like Substack, closed online communities based on platforms like Circle, membership subscriptions like Patreon, and story subscriptions like Wattpad or Ream. So subscription is a huge part of many author businesses now. So definitely worth reading that article, and it is a really substantial article to see if anything fits into your business model as a creator. And remember, one of the benefits of subscription, well, for the person who's paying the subscription, is that they get a load of stuff as part of their subscription. That's why we subscribe. But for the creator, it means you get more of a guaranteed monthly income as long as you're delivering value to your subscribers. and some podcast episodes you might enjoy on the Self-Publishing Advice podcast, Orna Ross and I discuss independence and interdependence, how we can be more independent and what it means for our creative and business choices, as well as why we also need interdependence within the community and also with the partner services and things like that, and how to foster those relationships. And I proposed that topic because I love getting emails from everybody, but I often get emails that say, this is my situation, I have this and this and this and this, what should I do? And I'm like, I can't tell you what to do. You're an independent author. This is part of your choices. The pros and cons of being an independent author are you are independent. So we talk about that. We talk about a lot of other things. As ever, Orna and I are very good friends and we have a good discussion. That is on Self-Publishing Advice podcast. Also, I'm on Ink in Your Veins, which is Rachel Herron's podcast, talking about how I got unstuck in my old career to begin again as an author. And Rachel's got lots of people on at the moment as part of her Unstuck Kickstarter. And Becca Syme is on there talking about her shift to a new city and why we need to recognise when a phase of life is over, which is a very powerful thing. I've done this moving country, moving city several times, several big times over my life. You don't have to move country or city to begin again, but it sometimes it helps. In AI news, as reported in TechCrunch, they say, if the decisions made by corporate boards of directors can indicate where a company wants to focus, Amazon's board has just made an interesting move. Amazon announced on Thursday that Andrew Ng, known for building AI at large tech companies, is joining its board of directors. They also said that Judy McGrath, best known for her work as a longtime TV executive running MTV and helping Viacom become a media powerhouse, will be stepping down. So it says, taken together, the two moves sketch out an interesting picture of the tech giant's intentions. So AI going on the board, media, TV coming off the board. Now, this is actually interesting because it was when Andy Jassy became CEO, I spoke about and have spoken many times actually about how I think Amazon could even spin off the whole media side of things into another company. That would also help with their antitrust case and all of that kind of thing. But it goes on to say, Andy Jassy, in Amazon's annual letter to shareholders, published shortly after the Ng announcement, went so far as to call GenAI Amazon's fourth pillar, alongside Marketplace, Prime and AWS, in terms of future focus. Now, that's interesting because I thought it would come under AWS, but they're putting generative AI as essentially another AWS, as in it could be as big as. So that's really interesting. Andy Jassy also said that generative AI may be the largest technology transformation since the internet. So again, I really hope anyone listening to this show has bought into the fact that this is a new wave of technology. This is not a fad. This is not going away. And Andy Jassy here talking about that. So yes, also I wanted to mention Andrew Ng is wonderful. He's a great teacher. He's a professor and he helped build all kinds of things. But I've done a couple of his free online courses. I've mentioned them before. I'll mention it again. AI for Everyone. It's a free course. It is they call it non-technical. To be honest, you do need to want to think about technical things to do the course, but it is really good foundation to a lot of this technical change. I actually think all authors should do it, since most people don't understand how generative AI works. A lot of the questions I get still assume that it's like a database that's full of stolen work, and that is totally not what it is. And if you understand how the technology works, it makes some of your questions go away in terms of what it can do and how the idea of reading books and thinking about them and that kind of thing. So anyway, I'll link to that in the show notes, or you can find that at deeplearning.ai. There are lots of technical courses, but this one's called AI for Everyone. And if you want to, and Andrew Ng, Ng is spelled NG. So another interesting podcast episode this week was Marketing Against the Grain, which is a little bit tech bro, but I do like it. One of the guys is Irish and the other guy is American, and they're very into their marketing and their AI. But the headline of the podcast episode is SEO is dead. 5 ways to save your business in 2024. And they talk about the greatest upset that's just happened in SEO since the Panda and Penguin updates over a decade ago. And I remember that. My website wasn't affected because I wasn't doing any of the stuff that they cracked down on. But in fact, my website has not been affected by this change. But this is a really interesting shift. And it shows you how generative search is changing things. So if you do content marketing in any form, if you write articles, if you do freelance articles, if you write them for your own site, this is an interesting episode. And of course, this is what I did a solo episode about in December, episode 727. So where I talked about how changes in search will affect authors and book marketing. So I'll link to that in the notes, or you can just scroll back on the podcast app to, to December. So yes, Marketing Against the Grain is the show. I often get some good ideas from the guys. So in personal news, so while Spear of Destiny was with Kristen, actually, as I record this, I just got the email back. So I'm not opening it till Monday. But yes, this week I have been working on my Kickstarter plan. I have absolutely loved working with ChatGPT to make a 21-day marketing plan, because I'm going to do a 21-day campaign. The last two I did 15 days, which I found hard to do. But I wanted, 21 days is a better number in terms of sort of collecting that last week of backers. Now, I don't usually even make marketing plans. I just kind of wing it, but it really helped to work with ChatGPT. I've got tons of ideas for the book, for marketing, and it also helped me with some stretch goals. Now, one of the stretch goals that it suggested was to write a completely new short story. And I was like, ooh, that's interesting. And I've had a couple of ideas muzzing around in my head. I don't know if muzzing's a word, but you know what I mean, like ideas that I've thought about. So I'm going to tell you a bit about it. I'm not going to tell you all of it because I want to keep half of it secret. I'm going to tell you half the idea. So a few years ago, I heard a podcast interview with the CEO of Colossal Biosciences. Now, if you haven't heard about them, they are a de-extinction company. Yes, de-extinction is a real thing. And yes, this is basically Jurassic Park. But the two animals they're planning on bringing back are woolly mammoths and also the thylacine, the Tasmanian tiger. And they have a few reasons for that. I think it's really interesting to listen to the CEO. if you want to, you can just look on your app for Colossal Biosciences and you'll find some interviews. He does them. He's quite charismatic. They've raised a ton of money. But of course, life will find a way if you like the Jurassic Park stuff and all that. And I've been thinking for ages, I really want to write a de-extinction story. But of course, since Michael Crichton did dinosaurs, that you can't do that. That's been done. Nobody wants to read. Well, some people might want to read more of that, but I want to do something original. And for a short story, there has to be some kind of twist. Matthew Riley did dragons in The Great China Zoo. If you enjoy Matthew Riley books, I really like him. Jonathan Mabry did hybrid things in The Dragon Factory in his Joe Ledger series. And Douglas Preston has a new one coming out called Extinction, and the cover actually has woolly mammoths on. So I presume that he has also used this same seed idea. So anyway, I was thinking about these options for stretch goals, and I am loving writing at the moment. And since I had this week free, I did the marketing plan on Monday. And then on Tuesday morning, I went for a walk and was thinking about this idea. And then something came to me and I was like, right, I love this idea. I'm going to write it. So I have actually written a 9,000 word short story. I need to edit it and all of that kind of thing. But so half of it, the title is De-Extinction of, I'm not going to tell you the other half. If you have read any of my fiction as J.F. Penn, you might be able to guess. If you would like to guess, you can email me, joanna@jfpenn.com, if you think you know. So basically what I'm going to do is include that as a for all backers as a stretch goal. So even if you back the campaign for just £1, which is like $1.50, you'll get this extra short story. So I'm hoping that some people, even if you don't want Spear of Destiny, will want this one. And then I'll put it on pre-order for the stores in like September or something like that. So yeah, it'll be a super real bonus. No one will have read this before. So yeah, I'm pretty excited about that. And I love this story. I'm in that stage of loving the story. Of course, that will change. It always does. I'm also planning on doing an author's level in the Kickstarter, which will have a 2-hour webinar on my discovery writing process that goes hand in hand with my research. So as ever, the Kickstarter pre-launch page is at jfpenn.com/destiny. So I have also booked a lot of trips over the next few months. I've got a day at a vineyard. Yes, I've actually booked a whole day learning the basics of viticulture, which includes a tasting, of course, although I think I'm driving, so I'll have to spit it out, which I've actually never done at a tasting, or maybe I'll just have to get Jonathan to drive me over or something. I also have a stone masonry course coming up and day trips to Gothic cathedrals, so I'm having serious amounts of input over the next few months as I work on my next projects. And I was thinking about this, I'm actually having a lot of fun right now, and I'm also not taking storytelling too seriously. I think this is where I've got to, and this is part of the 15-year pivot. And of course, it's a slow pivot. It was never going to happen overnight. But it's starting to sink in that I'm really focusing on JF Penn in terms of my creative work. And obviously still trying to serve you here on the show, and also my patrons behind the scenes at patreon.com/thecreativepenn. That's the way I'm serving this community. But yeah, I'm really enjoying all these book ideas. I'm loving story ideas. And I'm not obsessing about the kind of serious work of books. Obviously, I'm still a book person. I love books first. I'm not going to get into screenwriting or any of that. But yeah, I want this to be more fun. And this week, it was gleeful. This was a gleeful writing experience, which I feel like I haven't had for a while. I think part of that is because Spear of Destiny did turn out to be quite... there's a lot of serious history and serious present things, obviously. If you think about the cover of Spear of Destiny has the US Capitol in Washington, D.C. on the front cover. And it's based on some history of Nazis, but in modern day. So you can probably imagine some of where that story is going. And so there was a lot of deep research for that. So I think having fun is an important break from that. The book itself is still an action adventure thriller, but with a deeper layer, I suppose. But yes, I thought I'd ask you this question this week. Are you having fun? Are there gleeful moments in your writing? Now, it might be type 2 fun. So if you don't know, type 2 fun means it's hard at the time. So no one would describe it as fun during the process, but rewarding later. So type 2 fun, for example, was when I went like doing the Camino de Santiago. Most of that was type 2 fun, and but type 1 fun is the kind of gleeful fun. But there should be some kind of joy or sense of satisfaction, at least in the process, for sure. So that's my question for you this week. Are you having fun, type 1 or type 2? So thanks for your emails and comments and photos this week. Jan sent me a picture of the starting point for the Santiago de Compostela pilgrimage, the Camino. I live on this island, and this is the White Church of Den Hoorn, which is 2,500 kilometres, the most northern starting point. Wow, that's amazing. I live on the island and was driving past. I thought I'd photograph them for you. It's a picture of the church and the scallop shell. Texel, the White Church of Den Hoorn. Fantastic. And thanks to Tracy, who sent pictures of daffodils amongst the gravestones, saying, "We stumbled upon this beautiful scene while visiting Rochester for the eclipse." Oh yes, I saw some pictures of the eclipse. That looked amazing. Daffodil days at Mount Hope Cemetery. Lovely. 33,000 daffodils bloom here. Wow, that's so awesome. Patrick Martinez 1 on YouTube said, "Yay, my two faves in one podcast." Thank you, Patrick. And Bradley says, "Thanks for the tip to go listen to Seth Godin and Tim Ferriss." Wow, to get your stamp of approval and then Seth Godin's on Claude 3 Opus to get summaries or book descriptions, sales pages for our books is compelling. P.S. I love when you describe how your subscribers listen in. I'm usually with my dog in the woods, so my mind is less cluttered and I can better focus. Thank you, Bradley, and thanks to everyone. Remember, you can leave a comment on the podcast show notes at thecreativepen.com. The latest episode's always on the blog page, or you can go to thecreativepen.com/podcast to find the backlist. There's also the YouTube channel. You can leave a comment. You can message me on X at the Creative Pen with a double N. Or you can email me. Send me pictures of where you're listening. joanna@thecreativepen.com. I love to hear from you. It makes this more of a conversation. So today's episode is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, Kobo's free, fast and easy self-publishing platform. KWL was built by authors for authors, and their team of dedicated book lovers is always working hard to help you reach new readers around the world. And of course, now your books and audiobooks will be on the new Colour Readers, which is cool. Did you know you can publish an audiobook right in your Kobo Writing Life account? It's as easy as publishing an ebook. You can create a customizable table of contents, set the price in 16 different currencies, and even set up a pre-order for your audiobook with no date limit. You can add your audiobook to Kobo Plus, Kobo's non-exclusive subscription platform. There are lots of promotional opportunities for audiobooks published through Kobo Writing Life. There are also customizable social assets you can download to share on Facebook, X, and Instagram, making it even easier for you to reach this growing market of listeners. If you're a KWL author and don't yet have access to the audiobooks tab or the promotional mailing list, email the team at writinglife@kobo.com. That's writinglife@kobo.com, and they'll hook you up. Don't forget, you can purchase audiobooks at Kobo and they will download directly to your Kobo app or e-reader. And that's a free Kobo app or e-reader. If you want to learn more about KWL, check out the Kobo Writing Life podcast, available wherever you're listening to this, or find them on social media. Create your free account today at kobo.com/writinglife. So this type of corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, transcription and editing. But my time in creating the show is sponsored by my community at patreon.com/thecreativepen. Thanks to the 17 new patrons who've joined this week. And thanks to everyone who's been supporting for months and years. If you join the growing community, you get access to all the backlist videos and audio covering topics on creativity and AI. There are tutorials as well as mindset and business. Last week, I included my materials from pitching Catacomb, my pitch deck, slides, and also my 3-page outline. So people are finding them very useful. This week, I'll be doing the monthly Q&A where I answer patron questions. Basically, it's an extra solo show a month of between 45 minutes and an hour of me answering questions, talking about various things. The Patreon is a monthly subscription, the equivalent to buying me a black coffee a month, or a couple of coffees if you're feeling generous. So if you get value from the show and want more, come on over and join more than 1,000 authors. Thanks to all the patrons who support the show, and you can join us at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get into the interview. Tristra New Year Jaeger is the Chief Strategy Officer for Rock, Paper, Scissors, which provides PR for music innovators. She's also the author of historical fantasy and scientific romance and the co-host of the Music Tectonics podcast, which goes beneath the surface of music and technology. So welcome back to the show, Tristra.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me back, Joanna.
Oh, no, I'm excited to talk to you today. Now, you were last on the show 3 years ago, I know, it seems so long ago, in March 2021. And we actually started talking back then about the potential impact of AI in the music industry. So we're going to start there again today. We're going to start with AI. Things have obviously moved on, and you specialise in the music industry. Even in the last week, as we record this, I saw Rolling Stone wrote about Suno.ai, the ChatGPT for music. So I wondered if, let's start with the current state of AI for musicians. In terms of, I guess, the opportunities, but also, yeah, well, let's just do the positive ways at first.
Yeah, let's start on the positive. So Suno was a really interesting development in that it was the first general generative AI, something akin to ChatGPT or Claude, that could make really, really good convincing tracks. So no offense to all the other large models out there that can generate from scratch all music. Usually they were really short little sections of just like 45 seconds, and they tended to go off the rails pretty quickly. But Suno was a little bit different and sounds a little bit better. Now, if we're going to talk about generative AI for music, it's a little bit different, I would argue, and text, because there's a lot of different layers to music production and music creation. So for a long time, we've had AI that could generate melodies using the MIDI format. So that's not really like a full-fledged sound or melody you'd hear, but just like the signals that a synthesizer uses to generate a melody. And we could generate lyrics. That's been around for a while. And then one of the most commonly used aspects of AI is in mixing and mastering. So mastering is the final set of tasks we do to make a recorded piece of music sound polished and good. So to get all the levels right, to add a little bit of extra spark and sort of finalizing of that track. So mastering, AI mastering has been around for quite some time and has really taken off, and people will use it almost at every stage of recording in some instances, depending on what kind of music they're making. So in a lot of ways, the stuff that gets the news headlines really recently isn't the stuff that's really for musicians, I would argue. It's more for people who don't consider themselves musicians or who struggle to make music because they just don't have the technical background or the musical training. And that's what's really, really interesting from our perspective in the music business, is maybe we're looking at a future where we have a lot more people creating music, maybe numbering in the billions instead of the low millions. People who are making stuff for their own purposes, and it may not be the traditional commercial pipeline of recorded music of the past. It may not even be static recorded music. So in terms of the existing AI models and what they can produce, most of us agree that the biggest threat, if we're going to talk about threats, I don't know if I'm going to move. So that's a positive side, is the creative side. Let's talk about the threats for just a second, because they are intertwined. There is some concern about how are we going to manage this sea of content that, you know, we thought things were intense before. What's going to happen now if everyone starts, say, wanting to upload their music to Spotify or even to a SoundCloud or other platform? How are we going to ever find stuff that's good? But then there's also this question of a very specific niche in the music business that most of us hear all the time, but we may not think about, and that is sync or production music. So that is the music you hear behind an image. And AI really could completely upend that world. And if an advertiser or a video creator or an author making, say, a trailer for their book decides they know exactly what kind of music they want, and they can type in something cool into something like Suno and get a little clip that's licensed, and they know they're not going to get any copyright strikes or other legal complications from that, that really changes the game. And if it's way, way cheaper than even what exists now, like there are very inexpensive online libraries that have pretty decent music and a lot of different kinds of music, but it won't be as custom and it won't be as expensive, most likely, even as the existing sort of lower end of that market. So that is an interesting place. And some people are very concerned about that. And some people are really excited.
So. Yeah. Wow. Lots to come back on.
Just an onslaught of AI news.
I know, but I think this is good because there's a few things you bring out. So first of all, let's go straight for the stock music piece. Yes. Because we've seen the same thing. Stock, like, for, I used to, as a someone who has obviously this podcast, I do an image that goes with this podcast that goes onto the YouTube audio and onto the blog. I use images in my newsletter, for example. I use images on social media for ads. I used to pay for a stock photo service, and in the last 6 months, really, with Midjourney and with ChatGPT Plus, the paid version of both of those have commercial license. And I stopped all my subscriptions to stock photo. So what you're talking about there was stock music that might go behind. Oh, so I did license a piece of music from Audio Jungle for a book trailer. And what we're basically saying is it may be that with something like Suno or with some other tools that will arrive, but other tools with video are looking at generating audio with the video, that we wouldn't necessarily use something like Audio Jungle. And one of the things you said there was that that is a revenue stream for some musicians. So does that kind of sum up that issue?
Exactly. And so you'll start to see more and more integrations with platforms, I think, like Canva, where you'll have just, do you want to generate some music? Okay, what kind of music do you want? And just as we've become a little bit more savvy about how to prompt image generation, I think more and more people will get a little bit more in tune with how to prompt to get the kind of sounds that they like, which is kind of exciting. As a music nerd, I want more people to enjoy the pleasures of music nerddom. And that could really bring everybody a little bit closer to why does sound affect me? What sounds affect me? What are the names that we give to different sounds or genres or moods? And that's kind of an exciting moment for me personally.
Possibility, yeah. It's interesting you said, because I had a look at Suno. So I am, I don't know if I'm a complete weirdo, but I have very, very sensitive hearing. I spend most of my time listening to rain noise. Very occasionally I'll listen to some music, mostly from the 90s, like if I'm working out or something. But I don't listen to music much at all. So I am totally hopeless. So I went to Suno AI and it's like, type some words about what type of music you want. And I'm looking at it going, I literally don't know. So I still think there's this big gap between someone like you who could prompt an AI in a very clear way, knowing what they want, and someone like me who has absolutely no clue. So I do think that is a gap between those who know the language to create music and those who don't. I still think, and that's the same in fact, there is some research that shows that these models bring up the bottom level. So people who are terrible can become average. But these models right now, as we record this in March 2024, cannot be the best at any of these things.
That's exactly right. And you're always going to hit the middle of the road with these models. I mean, that's just how tokenization and probability work, I think, within the current way we create these things. So there's always going to be a lot of room for extraordinary thoughts, for really crazy upending of what we expect. And a lot of how our brain processes sound has to do with expectation. And that's where the emotion kind of comes in. And I think that both, so if we're talking about folks who don't create with music or really aren't, don't consider themselves musical, don't engage with music very much, there's a big window to bring some people who might never think musically, so to speak, into the world of making music and playing with sound. And, you know, that can come through things like stem separation and making it really easy for people to mess around with sound, way easier than it is now. And young folks, like if we're looking at how people use sound on TikTok or at cloud-based digital audio workstations like BandLab that are super accessible, kids are making weird sounds all the time and messing around with music, pulling things apart, putting things together, chopping things up, speeding them up. And that's really, really super cool. So I think we're going to see rising tide of people making music, just the way we saw people playing around with things like filters and lighting when Instagram went mainstream. So there's another side too, on the very, at the sort of top level of people making music, AI can really function in a lot of complex ways that are really subtle. So everyone's heard about voice cloning and things like Fake Drake or The Weeknd singing a song or all these sort of very gimmicky, goofy things. But the way those models actually work is fascinating. It's more accurate to call them timbre transfers. So timbre is like this sort of frequency qualities, right? This weird little sonic moments that define what makes a sound sound like itself. So if I hit a cardboard box, or if I hit a piece of wood, or if I hit a drum, those might all have the same duration. They might even have some similar frequencies, but they all have some, they all have a different timbre, right? So it's like that quality to sound. So the model basically lets you take the timbral patterns of another person's voice and transfer it to something else. You could transfer it to an instrument. You could transfer it to all sorts of crazy other sounds as well. It doesn't just have to be another voice. So the way you clone a voice is by making sure you have the same intonation. So if I used an Eminem voice model and I didn't have Eminem's really distinctive intonation, it wouldn't really sound like him. So there's kind of this interesting layer that's almost like a filter you put on a photo, or like a font. Like if you read a text in one font versus another, there's like this subtle little thing it changes in how you interpret and perceive that text. So anyway, these timbre transfers are the kind of tools that technically people with more musical training or more musical inclination might be able to use to really change how things sound, much the way people have used effects like reverb or flange, or how they've used synthesizers to create new and radically different sounds. There's a lot of exciting stuff that is hot, maybe a little bit more technical, a little bit deeper in the musical weeds, but is really, really cool. And I think will filter into mainstream audio creation as well.
Yeah, and I love that attitude. I think this is the right attitude, which is this enables new kinds of creativity that we've never seen before and we've never been able to do before. And I feel it's the same with the language models for writing. The way people who don't use these models assume that we're using it is output a thriller, you know, click one button, output an award-winning thriller. Okay, that just doesn't work. But like you said about the musicians there, I feel like as someone who uses at the moment mainly Claude 3, again, we're recording this towards the end of March 2024, these models change all the time, but I'm using Claude 3 and I'm going backwards and forwards, I'm iterating with it, I'm playing with it, I'm putting my words in and changing them and getting something else out, and backwards and forwards in terms of leveling up my writing. It's in fact slower to co-create for me with these AI tools because I'm trying to be better and use them to make my work better. And it feels like that's what you were saying with those more advanced AI assisted musicians.
Absolutely. And if we think about it as a conversation, it starts to get really interesting. And the thing that everyone often overlooks with AI, like we're so wowed at the moment by, wow, AI can make it sound, they can really sound like a customer service representative. Like, this is amazing, you know? But what's really exciting to me is how bizarre you can get the output can be from some of these models. So in my own writing, I wanted to play around with what it would sound like if an advanced artificial intelligence was having basically a freak out, like a really fun freak out. So what I did was I fed a bunch of 19th century spiritualist texts available on Google Books. I just fed a bunch of this stuff into, it was actually an earlier model because I like the early models are still super weird and you can make them output really odd things. And it spit out this totally insane rant. It was perfect. That's what I wanted. I edited it. I switched it around. It was work that I did as a writer after that. But the fun thing was, like, I would never have been able to get this weird and unhinged on my own. So that's just maybe an extreme example. And I'm sure there are much more gentle and civilized examples than the one I just gave. But that the weirdness, the emergent qualities are really where we as artists can thrive and explore and have a whole bunch of uncharted territory to wander around in. And that's exciting. Mm.
Yeah, it is. It is exciting. But let's come back to what you talked about, which was the potential challenge. Exactly the same thing happening with authors, which is this sea of content. You know, you thought it was bad before. It is going to get exponentially, let's say, worse in inverted commas, in that there is a sea of crap. And it's so funny because I have two opinions on the sea of crap. One is that a lot of the time, crap is fine. You know, like I'll have a McDonald's burger now and then as much as I want a really lovely meal at a nice restaurant. And I definitely do not read Pulitzer Prize winning books every night. So that I just watched the Roadhouse movie with Jake Gyllenhaal.
No judgment.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, it is a junk food movie. And so the sea of crap one is a lot of people don't mind that at all. Like we mentioned stock music. You don't need something amazing for your little book trailer. But the other one is that there's obviously just so much out there and that it's hard to find the good stuff. So what are your thoughts on, again, I mean, coming back to AI, using AI tools? I know you read my search article. Yes. Or thinking about other marketing possibilities. How do musicians and authors cut through this sea of content?
I think it is going to be a real balance between the human and some of these cool tools that we can use to unlock things and see patterns that we wouldn't see otherwise. In some ways, music and books are locked into this genre system right at the moment. Like, that's the language that we use to talk about things. And a lot of things that are not in the sort of sea of crap or more templated or just fun entertainment stuff tends to have, it's kind of hard to put them easily into one bucket, right? At least I can say that for music, that really good music artists really struggle to say, oh, I'm just making funk. That's all I make. Or I'm, you know, just straight up like old school hip hop. That's all I do. Because it's usually not all someone does. So in that regard, the using AI to help us find other similarities to other works. So with music, it's a little bit weird when it comes to search, because you can search using a bunch of different properties for an audio file. So you can look at the waveform and try to find other waveforms and sort of sound similarity search. You can look at metadata, which is a whole huge can of worms that if you ever want to make someone from the music industry cry, just talk about metadata.
Same in the book industry.
Exactly. But we don't want to make anyone cry here today. But it is so some metadata, when metadata is good and is doing what it's supposed to do, it can really help people find music. And then there's like things like user behavior. So the way a lot of recommendation algorithms are supposed to work is that you look at a user who is similar to you in some way, shape, or form, maybe in their listening habits, for example. And then you look at what that listener is listening to that you aren't listening to. And then the algo magically match makes and says, hey, your buddy who listens to like 80% of the same stuff as you really digs this and you haven't checked this out yet. So you should check it out. And I think I've gotten a little bit far afield here. So all of these different AI channels could converge, I think, to help us market better, if only because we're trying to find audiences in new ways and not just like, okay, this is a romance or it's a cozy mystery and I'm going to find all the cozy mystery writers. I'm going to do what all the cozy mysteries do. It's like, well, maybe there's like a whole world about like super intelligent cats, and there's like a super intelligent cat super fandom out there that you could discover if you had the right AI pilot, right? So in some ways, we might just leave genre behind. That's starting to happen in music. And I haven't seen as much reporting on this from books, but I'd love to hear your perspective, Joanna. In music, young listeners basically listen to everything. They just listen across the board. So it used to be like 40 years ago, people were pretty siloed. They were like, I do rock, or I'm into hip hop, or I listen to classical music, and that's it. Now it's like young listeners, their Spotify or whatever is just filled with all sorts of different kinds of music, and in all sorts of languages too. A lot of the music that is reaching young people now is not in English. So it could be K-pop, it could be J-pop, or from Japan is starting to percolate. And of course, Latin music, folks like Bad Bunny have really made a huge change. And now India is starting to come up on a lot of young people's radars as well. And it's fascinating. So anyway, all this to say, this is not very helpful advice.
Well, no, I think the point was that while we're looking at AI tools for discoverability, so I, for example, have found a lot of stuff with ChatGPT. I will say to it, the example I give in one of my posts was looking for stone carving, novels about stone carving. And when I used the traditional Amazon search, it came up with a whole load of nonfiction books on stone carving, and most of it was advertising and all this kind of thing. But then using ChatGPT, it actually gave me a whole load of really interesting options. And then you can also, with the generative search models, you can then ask more nuanced questions like, okay, well, then I want this to be historical, for example, or I want this to be set in Europe as opposed to America, or there are ways you can make it more granular. So I suppose the same would be true about music, that you could say, well, I like, these are the artists that I like, these are the songs I like, give me suggestions that are similar to this. And I mean, I guess what people are scared about, and this is already happening in the author industry, is generate to market. Mm-hmm. So this is going to be where, and in fact, I kind of saw this happening on ChatGPT the other day, right? So I asked it for a whole load of books on creative business and money for authors, because I'm going to update my business for authors book. Mm-hmm. And it came up with this whole list of books. And I was like, oh, wow, I haven't heard of some of these. These are amazing. and about four of them existed and six of them did not exist.
Incredible. I love
that. It was incredible, because that hadn't happened before. When I did that article before Christmas, that didn't happen. Like most of those articles were, those books were real. But the crazy thing was, and I said to Jonathan, my husband, like, look at this, look at these amazing book titles. And he said, well, maybe you should write one of those.
There you go. I mean, if you did that well, that could be incredible. And I think music, because it's a little bit like, it's a lighter lift in some respects. Now, musicians, don't get mad at me, but
as in, it doesn't take so long.
It doesn't take so long to create a, well, you can get, if you're creating, you know, obviously you could work for years on a single song and polish it and refine it and revise it and everything. But to, if you're working in like a song format, you're looking at what, like 3 to maybe 10 minutes of audio, and that can take a while to make. But a book, if you're shooting for a 50 to 100,000 word piece of fiction that hangs together reasonably well, I would argue it might take a little bit longer. As someone who's both recorded music and written music and
written books.
You know, again, it's not to the creativity and the heart and the soul is equally demanding, but it doesn't take as long. It doesn't take as long to make, and it doesn't take as long to enjoy. So anyway, the book side makes me a little like, wow, you'd have to put some effort in, but it'd be worth it. But for the music side, you could really go nuts.
I would kind of like to just feed in one of my books, maybe, and yeah. Ask. I mean, maybe I could do that. Maybe I feed in one of my books into Claude and I say, act like, is it Ramin Djawadi, the guy who did the Game of Thrones soundtrack?
Oh,
like,
there you go.
Yeah, I'd be like, yeah. Okay, do this for my book. Give me a prompt that I can put into, what is it called, Suno,
yeah, exactly.
And then see how it is. I mean, we're laughing because you and I are quite positive about this, but there are people listening who are like, oh dear. So let's move into the business model with stuff.
Can I just say one more question?
Yeah, sure.
On the fantastic fun side is like, but this is something I think a lot of authors experience, not everyone, but we're kind of like minor synesthetes, right? Like we're thinking across different, like we see what's happening before we write it, or sometimes we hear it. Some people may smell it. I don't know. This is giving us a chance in certain ways to unlock those sides of our imaginations, which we may not share that publicly, but if you had a soundtrack to Spear of Destiny, say, that might actually spark new creative directions for you that you hadn't unlocked before. So anyway, I think that's the multimedia side of things is really intriguing as all these different art forms converge. And it's something that is a little strange, but could end up being quite exciting from an imagination standpoint. So.
Oh, yeah. And again, I'm going to want to upload my book and then get... Well, I did this to Claude. I uploaded a short story and said, can you plot out a book trailer? And then I made the images in ChatGPT in DALL-E and then got the music for it. So it was a kind of collaboration in that way. But given that there are tools coming out, the kind of text to video models with music, I probably by the end of 2024, you could feed in a book and say, create a 30-second trailer, right, with music.
Exactly. Or what song would this person be singing?
Yeah, exactly. But no, I mean, that's the fun side. But coming back to the business, because I think to me, there are some really interesting things. So you mentioned a bit about the voice synth thing. And I think it was Grimes who said, take my voice, create records and give me the money. Give me half the money or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think licensing voices is going to be one model. But you wrote an article on the MusicX Substack and said the creator economy is fragmenting. And I've used this term splintering, but maybe you could talk a bit about that. Like musicians are not just making money on Spotify streams. That is not the business model anymore, right?
Yeah, there's no single business model. And for a while, so as very similar to what's happened in the author world, there's been a whole DIY music movement, and there's been some really key players that have knocked down the doors where a lot of the sort of, there was a lot of back office stuff that was happening. It was very difficult for an individual to hook into things like certain kinds of royalty administration, that kind of thing. And so that's all, those doors have come down. And a person with the right mindset can pretty much manage an entire music career on their own using pretty available tools that aren't outrageously expensive. So with that in mind, people are trying all sorts of different stuff. So there are folks that have built a whole career around live streaming. Now, there are folks that have built their whole career around various streaming platforms and making music to playlists or to market, right? So there's a huge interest in lo-fi and other sort of study or focus oriented sounds. And there are artists who satisfy that market. So there's all these different directions you can go in and really different ways to make money. And some people only play live. So in that way, it's very difficult to figure out exactly what the digital music world gave us was this insight into usage. But what's happening right now is that moment when most things could be seen online in some way, shape, or form is fading. So we have people who are selling LPs direct. We have people who have a subscription model that they use. We have musicians who are doing all sorts of really unusual things. And it's hard to get a good handle on what all the business activity is. So for example, there's some debate about how many indie record stores are actually giving their sales information to the folks that manage things like charts or sales, right? And I know there's something similar happening with books. There's just no one knows how much people are selling.
Yeah.
Even in a store, which is like a well-established retail outlet that's been around for decades. Like they don't report their sales data. So we're seeing all sorts of different, very niche models, as well as, of course, superstars and all sorts of stuff. But it's just like it runs a gamut. Yeah.
Yeah, the two things come back on that. So one, this invisible sales thing, I'm thinking a lot about this because my own revenue is now mostly invisible. So most of the money I make is invisible to any charts. It comes from Shopify, it comes from Kickstarter, it comes from Patreon. Mm-hmm. It, like you said, these are subscription, these are one-off, they don't report. I mean, Brandon Sanderson in the book world, $42 million Kickstarter, and that doesn't hit a list.
Like at that point, like who cares, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. But I mean, there are people, authors who are Amazon only sellers who never hit any list, you know, and the person who hits the top of the New York Times list is some traditionally published author who's sold a fraction of what some of the biggest indies are selling in other ways. And like you said, at this point, who cares? And I do wonder about this. Are we kind of post fame world where there's like music, there's Taylor Swift and Beyonce or whatever, and then there's everybody else? Like, do we care? Do we just get on with it?
Yeah. And is there going to be sort of an interesting market bifurcation or fragmentation where there'll be people that are into stars, they're into celebrity, and then there's people who are just like, I like to collect stuff that kind of suits me and I don't care who made it. As long as I like it, I'm just going to have this little, I mean, in some ways that was what obtained before the digital content revolution. I hate the word content, but I'm going to use it. You know, their people would have like their local record store and their local bookstore. And maybe there'd be like a weird, I don't know if every listener had this in their world, but there, when I was growing up, there was sort of these oddball little shops that would have mimeographed or photocopied zines.
Yeah, zines. I was going to say this is a zine.
Exactly. So, and none of that really registered on. So in some ways, we don't know how new this is. This could have been going on for hundreds of years, you know, thinking of broadsides and all the ephemera that was popular in the 19th century, for example, whatever. But the fact of the matter is, maybe we are in a post-fame thing, or maybe we've always been. And in some ways, we've gotten a little bit of got a little bit turned around in thinking that the loudest voices were the ones who were actually calling the shots. I don't know. It's an interesting moment. So in music, the hope is there's always a lot of talk about like musical middle class that's a little bit mythical because, again, the history isn't there. But there's no I don't think there's any reason to believe necessarily that the musical middle class right now is smaller than it was 40 years ago. It's just a different group of people. It's not session players, like the kind of folks you might have heard backing up Steely Dan, who are like these exquisite artists that just played sessions. It's not people who are selling CDs hand over fist. It's a very different group of people. But how big was that group 50 years ago? I mean, there's not a lot of great research on that. So I have this feeling it's not necessarily smaller, and it's not that. It's just certain people have lost ground, which is, of course, sad because they're making some good music. And yeah, it's an interesting question.
Yeah, it is. And I get what you mean. And it's kind of similar. I mean, you get to a point where you think, I really just like making stuff. Mm-hmm. I need to make enough money that I can pay my bills and I can keep creating stuff. And once you get to that certain amount of revenue, which is the mid list in the indie author space, for example, do you really care about the other stuff? I mean, I don't really. I mean, I have some particular goals, but they're not around fame. Mm-hmm. They have some recognition with my peers, you know, I recently won an award for my memoir and I was really happy with that. Yeah. That's not going to sell any more books, but I feel happy to be recognized by peers in a certain way. But yeah, and so I can imagine in the music industry too, there's people who are selling their, doing their merch and doing their vinyl press and selling it at an indie record store or whatever, doing their Kickstarter, doing their Patreon or whatever it is for music. And it's like, that's a happy creative life. And maybe that's just the positive thing about this new world, is that we're moving away from obsession with streaming and top of the charts into a sort of more happy creative life.
And it's less about broadcast or imitating old traditional media broadcast models. And it's more about this kind of, I think you put it as like an artisan approach. I pulled up some statistics before we started talking. There's a website builder called Bandzoogle, which I don't know if there's an exact equivalent in the book world, but basically it's a bunch of templates and tools and cool things that some indie artist-minded folks have created for musicians. And they just announced that they helped musicians earn $16.4 million in 2023. And most of that came from direct merch sales or direct ticket sales. And that's pretty interesting. So subscriptions aren't a huge thing for musicians, because like a lot of musicians, that's not really a model that's going to work for the way they make stuff. But I thought that was pretty notable. And Bandzoogle doesn't charge a commission. So that's money that's going straight into creative people's pockets. I thought that was pretty cool.
So yeah, I just pulled that up. So Bandzoogle, they build websites, made website management, tour dates. So it's websites and selling direct and merch and things through their site. That looks fantastic. Just on merch then, this is something that musicians have always done really very well, selling merch at live events and this stuff. And author events, people will more likely wear band t-shirts than they'll wear author t-shirts. Yeah, it's just not the thing to do. You don't often see,
you know, like, you just try to imagine, like, you know, my Melville t-shirt or like my
I mean, that it really is a cultural thing for bands, right, to do this. I mean, it'd be great if authors did this too. But do you have some sites that you would recommend if authors do want to do merch? What are some of the best sites you know of that they might have a look at?
I have been thinking about this myself for merch. One thing that I have been thinking a lot about is t-shirts and sizes and how hard it is to, I guess you can do print on demand, but the margin seems a little bit so-so. So I'm wondering, and if you're a band, you'll probably print a small run or a big run of different sizes and styles and things. And so I've been thinking a lot about that, like, what are some alternatives to t-shirts? And there's been some crazy variety of things that people have done in music. I would say if you want to look for some inspiration, look at places like Bandcamp. So if you have a favorite genre or artist, see if they're on Bandcamp and see what they're selling. Because sometimes music artists will sell really neat things that are pretty simple. So you probably don't want to go to the trouble of putting out a vinyl LP. There's ways you can make cassettes nowadays. They have all sorts of fun stickers. I've seen bandanas. There are things like drink koozies, if that's your thing. Like, if, I don't know, if I had pro setting some my books, like maybe a thriller in the Florida Keys, like a koozie sounds like a good piece of merch. That's the little,
it's like a beer sleeve, or exactly. your for your craft beer.
Exactly. So your seltzer water for
your hard seltzer.
Exactly. There you go. For authors, it may indeed have to be a hard seltzer. So I'm being silly. But there's the enamel pins. There's all sorts of really fun little things that you can look at. And I'm all for getting inspiration for other people and for thinking about, like, what is an object that's easy to mail, that's not too fragile, that is relatively small, that's something that someone would buy and enjoy, where design can really shine, like an enamel pin or a sticker would be a great example. And those are things that are pretty easy to manufacture. And I mean, I have to say my favorite thing, Joanna, and I'm going to give a little shout out, that I love Sticker Mule here in the US. And if you sign up with them, they will send out these deals, these like random deals. They have the best marketing emails. They're just like 50 stickers, $10 today. They're like, I love you.
It's funny. I do actually make my own stickers for my own journals.
Oh, that is so cool.
And I have thought about doing stickers. It's just, let's talk about selling direct, because as you mentioned, the biggest thing is I refuse to, as part of my business plan, I am not having stuff in my house and I am not going to the post office. So everything I do with my Shopify store, it has to be print on demand and it has to be shipped. I don't want it anywhere near me. It needs to go from the vendor. And you're also doing selling direct, aren't you?
Yes.
And you're also doing live events. I saw on your website, like things like bookshops and creative spaces and all of this, which to me just seems like a lot of work. So tell us about your ecosystem around selling direct.
Absolutely. You know, well, you've got a lot of plates spinning, Joanna. So there's some reasons why you might want to draw those really firm boundaries. And I love that. I think it's really important to know that about yourself as a creative person. And if I do all this stuff, is it going to completely destroy me as a writer? Meaning I'm not going to have any energy or interest in sitting down and being like, okay, so what is happening with these radioactive mice that are putting together an orchestra, so if you can't go and play with your imaginary friends, you can't pursue that particular thing. So in my case, I'm a baby author and I'm not going to hide that. And so what I mean by that is that most of the people I'm going to be selling to are people I know or people who know people I know, etc. And most of the stuff I've been writing lately has had a very strong regional or local flavor to it. So it's based in Indiana. It's based on the history of Indiana. It is a crazy, weird story based in the history of Indiana. So it's got a very specific audience. And I kind of wanted to have enough physical copies around to be generous with them. That is what my life allows. It's not what everyone's life allows. So for me, it made sense to print up a bunch of books and just have them there. And you know, having that, I have the space for it. I have the means to advance myself that, so that's not the right decision for everyone. It's a certain kind of privilege. But at the same token, I've been able to be really generous with my books, and meaning like if I want to give it to someone, I can. And that means a lot to me. And it's less of a business decision and more of just a human decision for me. However, I do really enjoy local events, but I don't always call myself an introvert. I do find it difficult to associate with people for long periods of time. Mm. And I find it really helpful for me to focus on ideas instead of my persona as an author or my own work even. So I often want to go and talk to people about the ideas or phenomena that inspired my book. So it could be artificial intelligence. It could be human utopias. It could be the history of frontier settlements in places like the US. And so I'll tailor what I want to talk about to each locale, judging by who their likely audience is. And so for me, that's worked really well because it keeps the focus off of me, which is very uncomfortable for me. I'm a Midwesterner. We just don't do that. and it also allows me to bring people into this world that was why I started doing this in the first place and really share it from a different perspective. So instead of the story and the little universe I generate for them in the book, we get to talk about the actual facts, historical sources, actions and events and people who inspired some of my writing. So that's really fun for me. I guess I would advise people to set themselves up for success. So try to know yourself. Start in your home turf. Start in a friendly location where you feel comfortable. Maybe even consider inviting someone along and setting it up as a fireside chat instead of just a you show, which can feel really uncomfortable at first. And also try to build the support around it that you need. So maybe schedule some time alone afterwards, or schedule some time with friends, or make sure that you have a little bit of promotional and marketing machinery in place. It could be really simple. It could just be on socials. It could be reaching out to local media. But don't leave yourself high and dry and just expect the store to do all the work. Because then for me, maybe I'm an indie author because I like to control things and I like to know that things are getting done, right? And I don't want to be angry with someone because something didn't get done, unless it's me. And then I can be angry at myself. So if you're going into an event, if you've decided to try this, I would say set yourself up for maximum success and know thyself. Try to make it sound as appealing as possible. And if there's no way it sounds appealing, don't do it.
Yeah, Exactly. And I flirt with this idea a lot and I do some speaking, but this is just not for me. But I do think, like, as we talked about, if you're being more analog with your products, then sometimes if you have the weird stuff, if you want to do the vinyl or the cassette tapes or the different type of books, it may be that this is something that really works for you, especially as you are, if you're embedded in the community, if it's about the local area. I think there's a lot of opportunity there that perhaps, as you said, this business model that's emerged in the digital space, people have thought more about the global digital side than they have around the local physical side. So interesting times ahead, I guess.
Absolutely. And just one more little thought about that is you can think about the global digital side. And I think that a lot of people are finding success there or it makes sense to them. For me, I had to think in concentric circles. Like I had to think about where's my home base and how do I expand out from there gradually and organically? And it's really frustrating because I want things to move faster than they do.
Don't we all?
Exactly, exactly. But that's a growth opportunity too, is to learn to be a little more patient.
Indeed. Right. So where can people find you and everything you do online?
Well, if you want to find out more about my music tech nerdery and musings, you can check out the Music Tectonics podcast. And that's tectonics like the geological phenomenon. You can also hit me up on LinkedIn. I know that's really dorky to say that, but that's where I do a lot of musings and post a lot of articles and stuff like that. If you want to find out about my fiction, I'm at newyearmedia.com. And I've got a podcast coming out in June about an American intense feminist from the 1820s. And you can find out about my novels. And you can also hit me up on Instagram, Facebook, you know, all those silly places where I mostly post things about barns. Barns, you know, trees, dark foreboding roads, that kind of fun stuff. So it's more of an
Oh, fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Tristra. That was great.
Thank you, Joanna. It's great to be here.
So I hope you found the discussion with Tristra interesting and that it gave you some ideas for your creative practices and your author business. You can leave a comment on the podcast show notes at thecreativepen.com or on the YouTube channel or message me on X at thecreativepen or email me joanna@thecreativepen.com. Next week, I'm talking about the mid-list indie author mindset with T. Thorne Coyle, where we discuss creative and business practices for those of us who make a decent or a very good living without being a super famous or seven-figure author outlier. So it's a great discussion and there's both, I guess, realism, but also practical thoughts around what it takes to run a business as a mid-list indie author, which I like. And we also discuss the terminology and all of that. It's a great discussion. And in the meantime, happy writing and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.